A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Rahman ar-Rahim. Maliki yawmiddin. Iyyaka na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. Ihdina as-sirata al-mustaqim. Sirata al-ladzina an'amta alayhim. Ghayri al-maghdubi alayhim wa ad-dallin. Amin. So I thought I'd read a little bit from this new Quran. And I'm taking this from chapter Saba, or otherwise known as Sheba, recorded in Mecca, revealed in Mecca, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. All gratitude and praise belong to Allah, to whom belongs whatever is in the universes and on earth. All gratitude and praise belong to Him in the hereafter as well. He is Al-Hakim, the wise one, Al-Kabir, the all-aware one. He knows what goes into the earth and what comes out of it, and what descends from heaven and what ascends into it. He is Al-Rahim, Al-Ghafar, the absolver of sins, the tolerant one. Those who disbelieve say, "This hour will never come to us," say, "No. I swear by my Rabb," that means Lord, "it is without a doubt coming to you. He knows what is hidden and what is, and not even the weight of an atom for elementary particle or less than that or greater escapes him in the universes or on earth. Rather, all is recorded in a clear kitab," meaning a universal repository of all knowledge. Kitab means book in Arabic, I think. "This is to say that he may reward those who believe and do good deeds. For them are absolution and a generous provision. But those who fight our ayats, revelations, and challenge them, they will receive such punishment that in severity will knock them senseless. Those who have been given knowledge can see that what has been revealed to you from your Rabb is the truth and leads to the path of Al-Aziz, the revered and most precious one, Al-Hamid, the one who deserves all gratitude and praise. Those who disbelieve say, do you want us to show you a man who will tell you when you have become scattered in fragments and completely decompressed? Even then you will be created all over again? Is he fabricating a lie about Allah, or is he deluded? But no, those who disbelieve in the hereafter, they are in torment and are far away from the path to the truth. Have they not noticed what is before them and what is behind them of the sky and the earth? If we wish, we can make the earth swallow them up or cause a part of the sky to fall down on them. Now there is surely a portent in this for every dependent who turns repentant to Allah. Truly, we gave favors from us to David. Quote, O you mountains and birds, echo his psalms of praise with him. End quote. We also made iron soft and supple for him through metallurgy. I'll leave that there. Comments? Any thoughts about that?
Just, the thing that just came out for me was belief versus unbelief. And, yeah, that can be quite broad. Allah is giving us the option.
Yeah. Sheikh Tanner talks about this in the Quran in terms of carrot and the stick. Some people are more apt to make changes based on fear, to not do wrong, to want to do the right thing. And there are those who do things because it's the right thing to do and feels right to do. So that's the carrot. So sweet and sour, whatever according to that person's needs, the Quran is there to help guide them to understanding. And so it uses both of these, and also, when you think about it, some people just want to be told what to do. Don't give me a lot of philosophy or anything. I just want to be a good Muslim, and I want to follow the right rules. I want to do things right. Whereas Sufis generally are asking, "So, what's this all about anyway? Where'd this come from? Why is it like this? Where did that start? What's the source? Why?" So some people want to know why, and some people just want to know what to do. So it's written in a very clear way in that way, and also pointing out through stories and allegories and science that this is what it is. Next, I wanted to read a poem from Hafez called "We Have Not Come to Take Prisoners." "We have not come here to take prisoners, but to surrender ever more deeply to freedom and joy. We have not come into this exquisite world to hold ourselves hostage from love. Run, my dear, from anything that may not strengthen your precious budding wings. Run like hell, my dear, from anyone likely to put a sharp knife into the sacred, tender vision of your beautiful heart. We have a duty to befriend those aspects of obedience that stand outside of our house and shout to our reason, oh, please, come out and play.' For we have not come here to take prisoners or to confine our wondrous spirits, but to experience ever and ever more deeply our divine courage, freedom, and light." Isn't that lovely? Whereas I think we are hostages to love in that way. I have a story called "The Journey." Is that the one I want? No, that's not the one I want. I had a better one. Fooey. I'll tell you the story. In this kingdom, there was scholars and people who read books were considered very smart and at the top of their abilities, and people responded to them appropriately and gave them status and were very kind and considered them learned. A Sufi came in to this, and the king asked him, "Well, we're all very educated and literary here. So, how many books have you read?" And the Sufi said, "Oh, not too many. I haven't really. Well, have you read this biography?" "No." "Have you read the literature of this person?" No. "Well, get out. You don't belong here." So the Sufi left, and about 9 months later, he comes back in and he requests to the king that he has something of interest to show the king. He says, "Well, you're obviously not a scholar, are you?" And the dervish said, "No, but I have a horse that may be of interest." And the king said, What are you talking about? May I bring my horse in, sire?" And the king said, "Okay. Somebody has to clean it up, but yeah, all right, fine, bring the horse in." So he brings the horse in and he puts down a fairly large book, and he says, "Watch." And so the horse opens, he opens the book, and the horse with its hoof moves the pages, goes back and forth like this, moves another page with its hoof, and looks up at the Sufi and goes, and neighs, and seems to be commenting on it. And so he keeps going like this and like this, and the king says, "This is remarkable. The horse is reading the book, and even seems to be commenting on what he's reading. This is incredible. Oh, this is fantastic. How did this come about?" And the Sufi said, "Well, listen, I'll tell you, but I want to ask to be forgiven and no action put against me." And the king said, "Yeah, oh, yeah, of course, of course." And the Sufi said, "Well, I trained this horse for about 6 months, putting oats between the leaves of the book. He added the neighing himself. I thought that was very appropriate." And the king said, "Well, that's almost the way that our scholars have to learn as well. They have to learn and be given rewards as well." And, huh. Thus, the idea of scholars and training, the idea that we are trained in this kind of behavior, and that we are conditioned to appearances and to be clear about for ourselves, what are we making our judgments based on? If somebody appears smart or they're able to quote different books or YouTube lectures, are they intelligent or what's going on here? Or are they just being programmed? You know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah.
Thoughts, comments, Rukaya? Anything you want to say?
I was also hearing in that one about the. Yeah, sorry, you got me?
Yep.
Can you hear me, Shay? Yep. I was just hearing about the role of the educator as well.
Ah.
About the dervish being the educator. And so it's like seeing past just the job.
Yeah, you're cutting out. I think your distance from the server is making it difficult to hear you.
Oh, sorry. Let me change to my off my headphones and touch it.
So you're talking about pedagogy.
Yeah, is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I know a lot of teachers who went into pedagogy and went into, you know, the upper realms of education and who lost track of what education was about.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very, what's the word, unconnected, disassociated from the actual feet on the ground. And this is actually one of the things that's happening in Florida, is there's certain laws that the teachers are supposed to obey about not making students feel responsible or emotional about history. And the teachers are going, "We don't know what to do. This is absurd. This is no way to teach." So this is happening right now. But yeah, is that what you mean, Rukaya?
Yeah. That one threw me, sorry.
I know, it just happened, and it's kind of like, well, that's Florida for you. Okay, I have a Nasruddin story.
That is insane. Just here is the information. Do not take us. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they really can't teach history. And they can't teach probably sexual education or anything else. Because people.
Yeah, because when you're teaching kids, it has to be immersive. Like, that's how they understand stuff more than just hear our words. Yeah, no.
Exactly. This is a part of our education. Learning how to think, to me, is primary. And learning how you think and how you learn is very important. We each learn in our own way. And as we talked about, we each have different intelligences. We have strengths and weaknesses. Learning what those are help us take in new knowledge and information and process it for our betterment, for us to get better at being human beings. Can we do a Nasruddin story?
Mm-hmm.
It's called Assumptions. What is the meaning of fate, Mullah? And he answers, assumptions. In what way? Well, you assume things are going to go well and they don't. That you call bad luck. You assume things are going to go badly and they don't. That you call good luck. You assume that certain things are going to happen or not happen, and you so lack intuition that you don't know what is going to happen. You assume that the future is unknown, and when you are caught out, you call that fate. Something to think about. Or destiny.
Mm. Well.
And it's what we were talking about before about, you know, the Sufi, well, first of all, the psychological idea that we all tell ourselves stories and we try to think that we're living our story. Whereas in some of the Sufi material, it says you don't know the story until it's done. Then you can tell the story. But if you're in the middle of it, you don't know the story. You're living it. Mm. If you start telling the story, then you're not living it anymore.
Mm.
You've just, in a way, disassociated from yourself. Then you're not being. You put concrete on the tree, and it can't grow anymore. All right. Anything else you want to say about that? Assumptions.
Yeah. Oh, just the aspect of being. Yeah, it comes through being fluid, being flexible, and. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not being stuck, and sort of remind me of the story that you'd once told about the was it a Chinese, was it a Buddhist story about the horse and the army and the farmer and his son, about when his horse, his only horse that he's got, the farmer's horse, runs away, and all the villagers said to him, "Oh, this is terrible," and he said, "Oh, maybe, maybe not."
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, reminded me a little bit of that.
It keeps changing. We don't know. How can we say something's, "Oh, that's such a shame"?
Mm.
And it's kind of like, well, maybe it isn't.
Mm.
Maybe it's a lesson. Maybe it's a blessing.
It's like, also like the story of Kadir and Moses.
Right. Right. Very often, I would say most of the time, we don't have enough data to place thing in its proper context.
So when we are planning something or have an intention to work towards something or bring something into being professionally or personally, it's like, yeah, okay, so I have an aim to complete something or to do something in 12 months' time, whether it's a professional project or a personal project, and we have good intentions because we believe that's what's good for us or what we want. But sort of what I'm getting from that is that, like, yeah, we ultimately we don't know, but we still have to take some sort of action, don't we, Shane?
Okay. This is an interesting door you've opened. Okay. When you make a plan, what we try to do as Sufis is try and get an inner and outer confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. So maybe we have a dream about it. Maybe we have an inner energy that comes forward that we say, this feels like a way I want to go.
Sure.
And then you look and check out, you do your research of looking at, well, is this a viable way? Do I kind of line up with my abilities and my connections to make this happen? Is this a smart way to go? And to be ready to adapt and learn as you go along, which it brings up a concept that I was given a long time ago about being what it means to be an artist of life. An artist of life in this sense is we don't know how long it's going to take. If we feel that this is the way we want to go, then we need to make the adaptations necessary for that to happen. It doesn't just happen because you request it or because you want it. You also have to learn how it works, what makes it the way it is, what information am I missing or experiences am I missing to enable this to be more of a path I want to follow. And I think there's the necessity of giving up the idea of time, of what time looks like. I don't think it's a thing that you something has to give for something to happen, whether this is like I have to go to school for this or I have to pay this amount of money to learn from this source or I have to get these books or, you know, something needs to happen for the next step to occur. And I think it's important to understand, first of all, you may not know the steps, and therefore figuring out, okay, what's my first step? If I want to get to this place here, I'm going to need to take this stairway to get to there. And I don't even know what's on those steps over there. I just know this is my first step. I need to, you know, maybe I need to get the right clothes. Maybe I need to get a connection to a school or a tutor or something. Right?
Yep.
Now, that means something has to give for that to happen. So it takes effort, but you don't know how much time that's going to be. Now, if time is the shape that you're working with,
yeah,
then something else has to go. And that may be free time. Because now, okay, so I've set 12 months for this. That means I have to work on this every day. to make this happen. I can't take any more days off. This requires everything I've got to make this happen in this amount of time. So, do you understand what I'm saying? It's kind of like something has to give.
Yeah.
In other words, or another way to look at it is nothing's free.
Mm.
You have to pay something for that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. It's, I suppose, where, and maybe this is the, you know, the assumption. So I'm sort of hearing that if we look at it from perspective of a learning, so okay, what do I need to do? What do I, something has to give. And at the same time, what am I learning about myself and about the project? But I'm also just curious, sitting with, is that ultimately once we get there to at the end of that project or that whatever we're working towards, we still don't know if it's good for us or not.
Nope.
No.
And that's
we may think it's good for us. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it's important to after a number of weeks or months or whatever is to assess, you know, and step back and look at things objectively for a while and go, okay, I started here, now I'm here. Am I learning what I feel like I should be learning, or have I learned something that I really don't? It's not really useful. I am not getting anything out of this, or this is not at all where I wanted to go with this.
Gotcha. Yep.
So I learned something, and that's just data. It's not good or bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
For example, I was really interested in doing voiceover work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I like doing it, and it's fun to do. So I took a class. I paid money to take a class from somebody that taught it. And then he got it. You know, he talked about all this, and we were all working on this. As there must have been like maybe 10 of us. And then he gets down to the nitty gritty, and he says, "It only works. This only works if you speak with your heart." And I went, "Hold on, that's not what I want to do with my heart. I don't want to, you know." Be giving my heart to talking about how beautiful this refrigerator is, you know, or how this car gets you where you need to go.
Yeah.
So I thought, nope, I don't want to do this. That, because not only that, but in voiceover work, you also, as you're saying it, have to smile, because that kind of comes through the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
Because the shape of your face influences the kind of sound that comes out.
So
the waves.
At that stage, you had enough data to know that, this is not what you...
And it was kind of like, you know, the veil lifts and you go, oh, okay, I get it. No thanks.
Okay.
And I had put, you know, a lot of time into it and learning about how to do that. So, you know, whereas these other projects that I've been doing, you know, they've taken decades. And it's kind of like I'm learning stuff I didn't know about, and it's fun. It's enjoyable. And it's useful. Does that answer
that makes
your question?
Sense. Yeah.
So the idea that, well, what are you willing to give up or pay for that thing? If it's time based, then something else has to go. If it's not time based, then, you know, what are you going to do? Rukaya, comments?
I was just thinking about the comment about talking with your heart. I know that it's very different when it comes from a sales perspective, but that's kind of something I think I need to work on, because anytime I try and talk with my head, it gets all, the words get all jumbled up and I mush them together and words just roll out of my mouth and I'm not paying attention to them.
Hmm. It's different when you speak with your heart.
Definitely.
And it's always a good practice. In business, if you're doing a business transaction, I think that's a different part of the brain. And you may not want to do that with your heart, but with a learning sense. You know, how does this work? Like, you know, any kind of negotiation. This is something that is learned. This requires study and one might be watching somebody who's good at it or working with them as an apprentice, as it were, to see how somebody negotiates something. That's not necessarily, some people are intuitive that way, but some people, like some of us, have to learn watching another person doing it.
This was less about business and more about social stuff, as well as I've got an interview on Tuesday, so I noticed that my brain was just getting really overwhelmed, and I was like, when you said that about talking from your heart, I was like, yeah, that's the way to kind of move around that problem so that it doesn't become a real stumbling block during an interview or during a conversation or whatever. And
good,
it's just,
good point.
You're actually conscious about what you're saying and everything.
Exactly. Very good. So this is when you keep your feet flat on the ground. You have your safe space around you. You feel safe and protected. And you feel like you're breathing, you're aware of your breath, and you don't have to answer right away. You return back to your center, you become present, and you listen to your heart and you respond appropriately. That's what I like to use my heart for, not selling refrigerators. So, okay. Oh, yeah, there was one more thing I wanted to read, and that was, yes, the inner pilgrimage of the heart. The inner pilgrimage, and this is from Secret of Secrets from Abdul Qadir al-Jilani. The inner pilgrimage necessitates a great deal of preparation and gathering of provisions prior to undertaking the voyage. The first thing is to find a guide, a teacher whom one loves and respects, on whom one depends, and whom one obeys. It is he or she who will furnish the pilgrim with the provision he or she needs. Then one must prepare one's heart. To wake it up, one recites the sacred phrase, La ilaha illallah. There's no God but Allah, and remembers Allah in contemplating the meaning of that phrase. With this, the heart awakens and becomes alive. It also remembers Allah and keeps remembering Allah until the whole inner being is purified and cleansed of all else but Him. After the inner purification, one must recite the names of the attributes of Allah, which will kindle the light of Allah's beauty and grace. It is in that light that one hopes to see the Kaaba of the secret essence. Allah ordered his prophet Abraham and Ishmael's prophets to this purification, saying, "Associate not anything with me, and purify my house for those who circumambulate it." Indeed, the material Ka'ab in the city of Mecca is kept clean for the pilgrims. How much cleaner should one keep the inner Kaaba upon which truth will gaze? After these preparations, the inner pilgrim wraps themselves in the light of the Holy Spirit, transforming their material shape into the inner essence, and circumambulates the Kaaba of the heart, inwardly reciting the second divine name, Allah, the proper name of God. They move in circles because the path of the essence is not straight, but circular. Its end is its beginning. That's very nice. Comments? Anything you want to say about that?
I found it really beautiful the way it said that the end is the beginning, because there's no end to life and to learning and to our connection with Allah.
That's right. Allah is limitless. And so when we say Allahu Akbar, we're saying Allah is greater than anything you can imagine. And learning the source behind the words and understanding that the source should always be the heart in this case can help you in lots of situations. The idea is, if you can be present and be with your heart in a situation, you will know what needs to be done. Sometimes what needs to be done is nothing. And when you feel your heart is, when you feel your heart and you feel present and you feel love and you feel that that essence of Allah is with you, you don't necessarily need to do anything unless the heart says, now you should do this. It's okay not to do anything, but to be with your heart. Very often, that is exactly what's needed. In the case of social context with other people, being quiet and being at peace within yourself allows another person, the other person, to also feel at peace and trusting, and may say something that they've been wanting to say, but nobody else was listening. In that way, you are being a helper. You're helping heal another person by not stepping into their space. Most people are used to being interrupted and not listened to. If if we gave each other space and time to be open, I think this would be a very different world. But let me tell you about myself. Yeah? Make sense?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Rukaya, anything you want to add? A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, Rahman Rahim, Maliki Yomadeen, Ayakana Budwa Ayakana Stahim, Idina Surata Mustakim, Surata Ladzina Nabta Alehim, Ayril Maghdubi Alehim, Wala Dali. Amen. Salaam Alaikum, Rahatullah Barakatuh.
Walaikum Salaam, Sheikh. Thank you. Thanks,
Rukaya. Thanks, Alameen.
Hi.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Salaam, guys. Have a good week. Bye.
Salaam alaikum, mureeds, seekers, curious, and interested listeners. We appreciate you and are happy to share our Sufi message. Your donation will help support our Sufi center in Sydney, where we do zikr, sobet, spiritual counseling, and healing services. We believe the message should be free, but it costs equipment, rental, services, software, and hardware to get this to you. So thank you for choosing our podcast among all the millions available. If you go to our website, AnsariSufiOrder.org, you will be able to donate through PayPal whatever you think this information is worth to you. Blessings and love, the Australian Ansari Sufi Order.